eye over to take the meat from my hand. It was challenging work, since the bird's natural tendency is not to trust a human. Training them for many months in captivity taught me the value of accepting small improvements day by day. After the trust was there, I could release the bird into the wild. That was the moment of truth. When I blew the whistle, would the bird return to my hand? This is very much like how we train our minds to return to the breath in peaceful abiding. It takes patience. When we experience a moment of peacefully abiding, it seems so far out. Our mind is no longer drifting, thinking about a million things. The sun comes up or a beautiful breeze comes along, and all of a sudden we feel the breeze and are completely in tune. We think, that's a very spiritual experience. It's a religious experience. At least worth a poem or a letter home. But all that's happening is that for a moment we're in tune with our mind. Our mind is present and harmonious. Before we were so busy and bewildered that we didn't even notice the breeze. Our mind couldn't stay put long enough to watch the sun come up, which takes 2.5 minutes. Now we can keep it in one place long enough to acknowledge and appreciate our surroundings. Now we are really here. In fact, being in the present moment is ordinary. It's the point of being human. Learning to be present for the moment is the beginning of the spiritual path. By sitting still and training our mind to be with the breath, we begin to relax our discursiveness. We see how the mind creates our solid sense of self and begin to discover the mind's natural state of being. With this experience, we can cultivate our garden. The flowers of love, compassion, and wisdom gradually take over, and the weeds of anger, jealousy, and self-involvement have less and less room to grow. In peaceful abiding, we become familiar with the ground of basic goodness. This is how we turn the mind into an ally. Part 2. The Art of Peacefully Abiding. 4. Taking Our Seat. When I was a teenager, I would sometimes go on retreat with my father. On one retreat, my practice consisted of 4 sessions of sitting meditation per day. My father would always sneak into my meditation room at the beginning of my session to see if I was beginning properly. I used to think, why doesn't he sneak in during the middle of my session to see if I'm maintaining my practice? After a while, I realized that he was interested in how I was taking my seat. He was watching to see if I had the appropriate attitude toward training my mind. The mind is the king and queen. We approach our meditation seat as if it were a throne in the center of our life. There are many statues and paintings of the Buddha in meditation posture. These beautifully illustrate how the posture is designed to allow natural strength and groundedness with some kind of openness and dignity. By taking an upright sitting posture, we enable the body to relax and the mind to be awake. You can use different postures for meditation, but under ordinary circumstances, sitting on either a cushion or a chair is best. If you're unable to sit, it is possible to do this technique while walking or standing or even lying down. However, the most efficient posture for this practice is sitting. When you sit down, take a balanced, grounded posture to allow the energy in the center of your body to move freely. If you're on a cushion, sit with your legs loosely crossed. If you're in a chair, keep your legs uncrossed and your feet flat on the floor. Imagine that a string attached to the top of your head is pulling you upright. Let your organs, muscles, and bones settle around your erect spine, like a coat falling around a hanger. Your vertebrae should feel as though they are stacked like gold coins, allowing for the natural curvature of the spine. When I was young, I would sit around comparing battle scars with a friend of mine who was also an incarnate lama. An incarnate lama is an individual who purposely takes a rebirth in a recognized lineage of teachers in order to continue working for the benefit of others. In the Tibetan tradition, this involves intensive, highly disciplined training. My tutor used to pinch me or use a bamboo switch, but my friend's tutor was more extreme. He taught his charge to hold his meditation posture by making him sit for hours on a rock surrounded by thorn bushes. If he moved, he'd be stuck with thorns. Although it sounds harsh, it was effective in teaching him to sit very still and upright. The reason these tutors put so much emphasis on sitting up straight is that slouching impairs the breathing, which directly affects the mind. If you slump, you'll be struggling with discomfort in your body at the same time that you're trying to train your mind. What you want to be doing is the opposite, synchronizing your body and mind. After you work with getting your spine straight, place your hands on your thighs. They shouldn't rest so far forward that it begins to pull your shoulders down, nor so far back that the shoulders contract and pinch the spine. The fingers are close and relaxed, not spread out in a grip, as if you can't let yourself go. Tuck your chin in and relax your jaw. The tongue is also relaxed, the tip resting against your upper teeth. Your mouth is ever so slightly open. Your gaze is downward with the eyelids half shut. If the gaze takes in too much, it will be hard to abide peacefully. On the other hand, closing the eyes completely might encourage you to fall asleep or to withdraw your mind from the technique. If your mind feels removed and insular, intense and dark, try raising the gaze and allowing more space into your practice. The eyes aren't looking, by the way. The eyes just see. It is the same with sound. We aren't listening, but we do hear. In other words, we're not focusing with our senses. The first step of the meditation technique is placement, placing our mind on the object of meditation. One of the Tibetan words for meditation is gom, which means to become familiar with. In meditation, we are introduced to an object and become familiar with it. We could use any object, a pebble, a flame, or the body. Our usual object of meditation, and the mind is always meditating on something, is me. In peaceful abiding, the object is the simple act of breathing. The breath represents being alive in the immediacy of the moment. Placing the mind on the breath and returning to it again and again is the essence of shamatha. Through resting the mind on the breath, we stay present, awake, and mindful. Placement means staying with the feeling of the breathing. The flow of the breath soothes the mind and allows for steadiness and relaxation. It also reduces discursiveness. This is ordinary breathing. Nothing is exaggerated. We just breathe. If you're having a hard time staying with the breath, spacing out or losing track between breathing out and breathing in, counting the in and out cycles of the breath can be a helpful remedy to bring yourself back to focus. We breathe in and then out. 1. In and then out. 2. If you use this method, count 7 or 21 breaths and then start over. If you become distracted and lose count, start over again at 1. Once you are more focused, you can drop the counting. Becoming familiar with the subtle rhythms of the breath is part of the natural development of peaceful abiding. We're placing the mind on the whole breath, and it takes time to feel what that is. We might discover that the breath itself is not as solid as our concept of the breath. We might see that the word breath describes something that is not so much one entity as a series of events. Air enters through the nostrils, the abdomen expands, and the breath rests there for a moment. Then the diaphragm contracts and the breath leaves the lungs, gently exits the nostrils, and dissolves into space. Using the breath as our object of meditation is very good because the air moving in and out allows us to have some kind of steadiness in contrast with our discursiveness. It also allows us to relax. That is the virtue of the breathing. Through placing our mind on this process, we relax our whole being. Tensions begin to dissolve. The breathing soothes the mind and allows it to rest. As our thoughts slow down and we settle into ourselves, the division between mind and body lessens. We start to feel our heart beating. We sense the flow of our blood. We can almost feel our bones. We become a whole being, with a synchronized body and mind. But that's not all that's happening. As we sit and place our mind on the breath, the natural playfulness of the mind continually arises. The movement of thoughts and emotions distracts us. We tend to get lost in the flood. We're thinking about how interesting it is that we're finally meditating, and wonder what our friends think. We're thinking about where we park the car. We're thinking about how good a cookie would taste right now. We're thinking that we're sleepy and could use a cup of coffee. These thoughts are little stories we're telling ourselves. Most of them concern the past and future, not the present. We may become swept away for a while and forget that the breath, not the thoughts and emotions, is the object of our meditation. The technique at this point is that when we notice that we're thinking, we acknowledge it. We can label it if we wish, thinking. Whether we label it or not, when we notice it, we bring our minds back to the breath. In acknowledging thoughts, we're recognizing the movement of the mind, the wildness of the bewildered mind. We're training in awareness of who we are as human beings. We're training in being undistracted and focused. We're training in being fully present for our lives. For example, we're holding a sturdy and relaxed posture and have placed our mind on the breath. We relax into the breathing and are in the midst of peacefully resting our mind when a thought pops up. I hope I don't have to cook again tonight. Why doesn't anyone else cook dinner? I'm the only one in the house who's really working anymore. Who do they think I am, Superman? Our peaceful abiding has been flooded by a current of thinking that is about to become an emotional torrent. At some point, we see this. Oh, I'm thinking. Acknowledging it, we allow the thought to dissipate, and we return to the breath. We realize that now we are practicing meditation, so it is not the time to think about those things, but to simply pay attention to our breathing. We refocus our attention and say to ourselves, "Now I am placing my mind on the breath." Beginning to meditate is like learning how to ride a horse. We have to learn to balance. We're learning to balance working with the breath, sitting up straight, and recognizing, acknowledging, and releasing thoughts. We feel like we should be able to do this right away. But meditation is relatively subtle, and getting it all coordinated takes some time. As we're learning to peacefully abide, we'll be falling down, getting up, falling down, getting up. It's important to be gentle and allow a bit of a grace period. We'll tend to hold our mind too tight. We're sitting there, a thought arises, and we think, "Oh, thoughts are bad." We become irritated trying to deal with the thought, so we overreact and squash it. Yet at this stage, a certain amount of thinking is inevitable. Eventually we begin to realize that the breath itself is soothing. We enjoy the breath. It's not some sort of nasty reminder to work harder. We're simply breathing in and out. It's as if we're discovering for the first time that we are breathing human beings. Then we might go through a period of meditation where we realize, "My goodness, my heart has to beat and my blood has to flow in order for me to stay alive." We're experiencing our physical body. We're developing the ability to check in with that very basic quality of who we are. We might even experience a level of fear when we see how tenuous it all is. We need precision to apply the technique and bring our minds back to the breath. It's said that great meditators become so centered they can feel their blood flow. They can actually sense the atomic level of their cellular structure. We need gentleness to keep the process neutral and light-handed. We don't need to analyze or judge a thought when it arises, or judge ourselves for having it. The contents of the thought, whether it's about the football game or our deepest, darkest secret, are neither good nor bad. A thought is just a thought. Chastising ourselves for thinking is also just a thought. So the instruction is to see the thought as a distraction and come back to the breath. This kind of gentleness makes for a healthy meditation practice. One of the main obstacles to thoroughly enjoying meditation is aches and pains. Our knees throb, our back aches, our shoulders feel tight. The possibility of pain is enough of a deterrent to keep some people from practicing in the first place. I often encounter people who assume that the meditation posture is supposed to be painful. That's unfortunate because it is meant to feel good. Bodily pain is not a mandatory aspect of meditation. Peaceful abiding is not restricted to our emotional state. Meditation relaxes our whole being, which of course includes the body. Since we may not be accustomed to sitting still for long periods of time without being held up by chairs or pillows, however, we have to be gentle with ourselves. There is a process of getting used to the posture. Westerners often find the idea of sitting on cushions daunting because we're not used to sitting on the floor. In Tibet and other Asian countries, however, people are uncomfortable sitting in chairs. Halfway through a banquet once, I noticed that Shibata Sensei, my Japanese archery teacher, had given up sitting Western style, drawing his legs into a cross-legged position on his chair. Whether we sit in a chair or on a cushion, the important point is to realize that bodily pain can and should be soothed as we practice. In order to make the journey of meditation, we have to include our body in our practice and allow it to loosen up as the mind relaxes. Once we're settled into our posture, we make a clear and precise beginning to our practice. It's not necessary to do this with a gong or a bell the way Buddhists traditionally do. You can just say to yourself something like, "Now I will begin to work with my mind and develop peaceful abiding." You can start by sitting for 10 minutes once a day. If you want to make your session longer, expand it to 20 minutes. If you want to sit more than once, try sandwiching your day between one session in the morning and one in the evening. If you can't practice every day, choose 3 or 4 days a week for practice and stay with the schedule. If you're temporarily busier than usual, working on a big project or taking exams, for example, adjust your sitting schedule accordingly and stick with it. Consistency is important. See Appendix A, Preparing to Practice, for additional information. At the end of your session, try not to just jump up and rush back into your daily activities. Enjoy the space that has been created by your meditation, and arise. Perhaps you'll feel a little more fresh, clear, and peaceful than before you started. In daily life, you don't have to carry over any particular technique. Don't eat, drink, or walk like a zombie. You can just relax, and then perhaps continue to allow your understanding to deepen. With a mind less busy with thoughts and chatter, you've created helpful space within yourself to carry forward into your day. You'll find it easier to be present, both in terms of perceiving what's happening around you, and also in communicating more clearly with others. It'll be easier to see thoughts and emotions for the distractions that they are. The instruction is really pretty simple. When you lose your mind, come back. When the horse runs away with you, bring it back to the trail. Be playful in this. Experiment with tuning into your sense perceptions, for example, to bring the horse under control. Or practice straightening your posture when you see that your mind has gone wild. Practice meeting the eyes of the person you're with and really listening to what they're saying, instead of prefabricating your response as they speak. Use the mindfulness and awareness that you developed on the cushion to stay in the saddle of your life. Then see if you can appreciate these fruits of practice without expectation or attachment. As meditation becomes part of your life, you might encounter obstacles and questions. It's helpful to have the support of more experienced practitioners who have come face to face with similar issues. A meditation instructor can give you tips on aspects of practice that you find difficult. Talking about your experiences with someone else and being part of a community of fellow meditators can be a tremendous support. 5. Mindfulness and awareness. The more consistency with which we practice bringing our mind back to the breath, the more we know that basic stability will be there when we sit down to meditate. How are we going to hold the mind to the breath? Just by taking our seat, we've got the wild horse saddled. Our tools in training it are mindfulness, trenpa, and awareness, shishin, presently knowing. The power of mindfulness is that we can just bring our mind back to the breath. The power of awareness is that we know when to do it. Awareness knows when the horse is bolted and tells mindfulness to bring it back. Bringing our minds back to the breath sounds simple, but when we start to practice it, we discover that it's quite the opposite. We're so thoroughly trained in following our thoughts that our mindfulness is weak. Our awareness isn't too strong either. At the beginning, it's hard for us to see where we are and what we're doing. The good news is that mindfulness and awareness are intrinsic aspects of the mind, not something foreign that we're trying to bring in. Mindfulness is what we use to hold our minds to any object, the breath, a rock, or a banana. And awareness is the intelligence that tells us what we're doing. Awareness is what tells us that the phone is ringing. When we answer the telephone, it's mindfulness that holds us to the voice at the other end long enough to know that our mother is calling. So in meditating properly, we're strengthening aspects of our mind that are already there. It's like working out. In developing mindfulness and awareness, the mind begins to feel its strength and its ability to simply be present. We begin to get a glimpse of the mind's natural stability. When I first started weight training, I could lift only a little bit. But with every repetition, I was building my strength. I didn't become strong from lifting one massive weight at once, but from doing repetitions consistently and regularly and building strength over time. This is exactly how we strengthen mindfulness and awareness, through consistent and regular practice. As we begin to meditate, what we experience most is the movement of the wild horse mind. We're following the breath and, whoa, the horse has gone off the trail and we're lost in the bushes, about to go over a cliff. That ability to notice where we are is awareness. Like a spy on the lookout for trouble, it alerts mindfulness to come and do its job. Sitting tall in the saddle with the reins firmly in hand, we bring the horse back to the trail. In sync with the horse for a moment, we feel tremendous energy and clarity. This is a powerful experience. For a moment, our mind can relax and expand out. Then, whoa, the stallion's caught the scent of a mare. He's been galloping up a hill for some distance before awareness kicks in and tells us that we're no longer on the trail. Our mind has drifted from the breath. We're thinking about the best way to make a salad or carefully reviewing the last movie we saw. If we let ourselves sit there and think, we are ingraining discursiveness. How do we bring ourselves back to the breath? Time to apply mindfulness. Meditation is proactive. Mindfulness has three qualities: familiarity, remembering, and non-distraction. Developing these three qualities is how we learn to ride our wild horse mind. The breath is a mechanism we use to practice centering our mind in the present moment. We begin by using it to become familiar with the mind's natural stability. At first, we're not sure what the breath is, and sometimes we're not able to recognize the present moment either. Distractions keep pulling us away. After some practice, we're able to recognize a thought, let it go, come back, and be present. Sometimes we feel that there is nothing to come back to, so we don't stay around for long. We say, nothing interesting here, might as well go back to Tasmania, or wherever we thought we were before. If we don't become familiar with the inherent stability of the mind, there won't ever be anything interesting about coming back to the present moment. We'll just be holding on by our fingernails because we think we have to. We know that acknowledging, recognizing, and releasing thoughts reduces discursiveness, but we also need positive reasons for coming back to the breath. This is the virtue of familiarity. Once we relax and get into the movement and rhythm of the breath, the present moment and the breath become very familiar. Our distractions and discursiveness are no longer quite so seductive. By training our horse consistently, we become intimate with how it feels to be peacefully riding the trail. We'd rather return to the present moment than chase a thought, because we're becoming familiar with the stability of our mind and we enjoy it. It's relaxing and comfortable to rest there. Like going to our room to be alone when the house is full of people. The second aspect of mindfulness is remembering. Remembering has an unstudied quality, like not forgetting our own face. It means we're so steady in our mindfulness that we always know what we're doing in the present moment. We're always remembering to hold our mind to the breath. If we're caught up in thought, we're forgetting that we're meditating. When we're replaying last night's hockey game in our head, we've lost our mindfulness. Remembering is like being in love. Wherever you go, your lover is always in the continuum of your mind. You're always conscious of who your lover is, where your lover is, and what your lover might be doing. In beginning meditation, we experience the movement of the wild mind. As we develop mindfulness, becoming familiar with the breath and remembering to return, we finally settle into this continuous state of not forgetting. It takes regular practice. Before, the mind was scattered. As it stabilizes, its natural aspects arise. It has more energy to be where it is, which is mindfulness, and to know what it's doing, which is awareness. The stability provides a continuum that becomes a foundation for building strength. We see this strength in the third aspect of mindfulness, which is non-distraction. As we develop non-distraction, we place the mind on the breath and it stays. Though it's hard to imagine when we first began to meditate, if we stick with our practice, our mind's tendency to fly like a horse out of the gate will disappear. The mind's natural stability and strength will shine through any potential distraction or discursiveness. It sees, it hears, it smells, it thinks, it feels. But it no longer chases wildly after these perceptions. It no longer jumps around. With the mental frequency no longer vibrating with movement, we experience the naturally even and immovable quality of the mind. When you're training a horse, at first you have to kick it to make it go left. Later, all you have to do is make one little finger gesture and the horse immediately does what you want. You're in tune with each other, and there's a sense of complete harmony. Riding doesn't exhaust you, just as meditating won't exhaust you. Once you develop this rapport with the horse, you can let the reins go. The horse will naturally veer away from branches. It will slow down if it's dangerous. With meditation, we're developing the same kind of rapport and understanding with our mind. Once we've tamed our mind, it stays in the present moment. When we have developed the elements of familiarity, remembering, and non-distraction, we can say we are truly mindful. Our mindfulness is mature. We have wind horse, an uplifted feeling of discipline and delight. We're no longer so distracted that when we bring ourselves back to the breath, we have to hold on for dear life. We can see clearly what is. This clarity is able to perceive phenomena very directly, What usually hides it is the discursive activity of thoughts and emotions. As the chatter begins to dissipate, clarity has an opportunity to arise. This quality of the mind is straightforward and vibrant. There's not a lot of thinking going on, and we perceive very clearly what is happening in our body and in the environment. The mind feels light, and at the same time it is not disturbed because it is stable. We can experience the same clarity of mind in mundane situations. When the sun comes out after a storm, when we roll in the snow after taking a sauna. In Tibet, people say that it's like taking a bath in milk. I went snorkeling recently, and it was a very vivid experience. My body felt light and buoyant, and there was a penetrating clarity to the sunlight shining through the turquoise water on the fish and the coral. Mindfulness and awareness bring us into such a space, and as we stay there longer, that space gets bigger and bigger. We have the ability to be intimate with the whole environment, our state of mind and the quality of our meditation. Our awareness is so keen that, like a sheriff in the Wild West, it can see trouble brewing before it even hits the horizon. Not only are we able to maintain our seat and keep the horse on the trail, but we're also able to extend ourselves panoramically. Before it even arises, we can prevent a thought from destabilizing our mindfulness. This is how we prolong the continuity of peaceful abiding. At this point, we can say, I am mindful of the horse. I am mindful of my meditation. I am mindful of the present moment. Off the cushion, we're no longer lost in daydreams. We're mindful of our food and it tastes better. We're mindful of sounds. Music is more beautiful. We're mindful of the people around us. We appreciate them more. We feel more alive and enthusiastic about life because there's less buffer between ourselves and what's happening. Our mind is a powerful ally that helps us focus on what we need to do, study, play sports, cook. Everything we do seems more simple, straightforward, and clear. Total mindfulness means being completely in tune, kind of like the old spiritual jargon of being one with something. However, in Buddhist terms, there is no one to be with. True mindfulness is no separation between here and there. It's a long way from the beginning of practice, but we can certainly aspire to reach the point where we can say, I am the breath, as opposed to, I know the breath. The sense of separation between our mind and the breath begins to dissolve. At this stage, there's nothing to hold on to. We transcend every reference point. The dualistic mind is dissolving. We experience unity with the breath. The less duality we experience, the less we will suffer. Eventually, our dualistic mind exhausts itself. We no longer need an object of meditation. The natural quality of meditation relaxes into boundless, unimpeded freedom and space. The dualistic struggle is over. This is peace. Before we reach that point of unity with space, the mind has to be strong, stable, and clear. That's why we meditate. Generally speaking, the mind is always outside or inside itself. Inside, in that it's self-obsessed, and outside, in that it's always leaving. However, by developing mindfulness and awareness, the mind is being drawn back to itself in a positive way. By settling, it becomes an ally. We are completely in tune and harmonious with it, and it's a joy and a relief to be ourselves. 6. How to gather a scattered mind. The bewildered mind spends much of its time racing from distraction to distraction, from sound to sight to smell, from feeling to desire to disappointment. It's in a constant state of flirtation. On any given day, our consciousness is fragmented and scattered in all directions. Yet when thunder shakes the sky, we're suddenly sharply focused. For a moment, our scattered mind is gathered whole, placed fully on the sound. For a split second, we are completely meditating on thunder. We practice peaceful abiding in order to cultivate that kind of one-pointed attention. It gives us the potential to have stronger, more focused access to whatever we're doing. We settle down to practice in order to draw in the scattered energy of the wild horse mind. We're bringing the mind to attention. With mindfulness and awareness, we gently and precisely pry our mind away from fantasies, chatter, and subtle whispers of thought, placing it wholly here and now upon the breath. We do this because our scattered mind continually seduces us away from our stability, clarity, and strength. So we center ourselves in our mind and place that mind on the breath. We gather it to ground ourselves in a healthy sense of self, wholesome, balanced, confident, pliable. Gathering the mind is a gradual process. We can imagine the mind's activity as circles of light radiating outward. Peaceful abiding is like taking the dispersed light and gathering it into ourselves. As we gather it closer, it grows brighter. The outermost circle represents our daily life. As we move in toward the center, we work with different levels of thoughts, from the gross to the subtle. The light grows gradually more focused. The point in the middle of the circle represents the fortitude and clarity that underlie the wildness of our scattered mind. Shamatha practice begins with gathering ourselves at the outermost circle, who we are in our world. Sometimes when I'm instructing children, I say, sit there and think about who you are. Think about what you like and what you don't like. Think about what it is to be mean and what it is to be kind. We should do this same kind of contemplation before placing our mind on the breath. Perhaps we've never before taken the time to see ourselves so clearly. Making our mind an ally requires self-awareness on every level. So after we sit down and before we begin practicing the technique, we should slow down and reflect on our presence in the world. We need to think for a few minutes about what we like and what we don't like, what we're worried about, and where in our lives we feel a sense of relief. This is how we cultivate self-awareness even at the outer ring of our lives. Having the patience and honesty to be self-aware is the basis of a healthy sense of self. We embody this healthiness in the meditation posture, grounded, balanced, and relaxed. That's what we gather in the outer circle of shamatha. We take a step into the next circle when we begin to apply the technique, following the breath and acknowledging thoughts as they arise. As new meditators, we'll probably be surprised by how many thoughts we have. When we take our seats and rest our mind on the breath, the sheer volume of thoughts can be overwhelming. This experience is so well documented by the lineage of meditators that it's traditionally described as a waterfall. We're more affected by the volume of water rushing over the falls than by our thoughts' variety or intricacies. Now we may think, I wasn't this bewildered before. Meditation has made my state of mind worse, and it was supposed to give me peace, liberation, and tranquility, but now I'm more angry and irritated than ever. Either we're right, and meditation does increase mental activity, and all those practitioners over thousands of years who were some of the most brilliant people ever were wrong. Or maybe we're just recognizing a level of thought and emotion that we had never stopped to notice before. This glimpse of our wild and overheated mind frightens us. Meditation is showing us the nature of the beast. This is why it takes courage to practice peaceful abiding. At first, our practice revolves around just recognizing the individual thoughts in the rush. Finding the breath within the torrent of thoughts might feel impossible. We know it's here somewhere, but when we look for it, we get lost and distracted by the waterfall. This stage is really important, worthy of appreciation. By recognizing the wildness of our mind, we begin to develop synergy with it. Seeing the torrential rain of thoughts is how we begin to train the horse. We can regard this as a positive experience, even though it may not feel that way. We can't possibly meditate without having first experienced the wildness of our mind. So we simply recognize those thoughts, and then we recognize them again. We're noticing the movement of our mind. Once we've recognized them, we begin to acknowledge them in passing. Oh, a thought. The point is to be quick and neutral. If we look at the thoughts slowly, deliberately, or judgmentally, we'll only add more thoughts to the process. That won't help. A thought has occurred. It is neither good nor bad. Recognizing and acknowledging brings us back to where we are, sitting on a cushion and trying to place our mind on the breath. We're learning how to cut through the discursiveness. At every stage, shamatha is a practice of noticing how the mind vibrates, how it creates story, speed, and solidity, and learning how to tune it to the present moment. As beginning practitioners, we're acutely aware of the movement of the mind. To recognize a thought is to see the mind vibrating. To acknowledge that we're thinking slows the movement down. When we recognize the mind's movement, we realize the possibility of peaceful abiding. When the mental frequency is no longer vibrating with movement, we experience the naturally even and immovable quality of the mind, if only for a moment. In gathering our scattered mind, we begin to discover who we really are right now, just by seeing that the web of thoughts we solidified as me is actually a series of vibrations. If we don't learn to see through this web, however, our continual dreamlike fabrication of me will continue to be our meditation. We could be enveloped in it for our whole life. Believing that thought patterns are a solid self is the source of our bewilderment and suffering. Seeing through the simple misunderstanding is the beginning of enlightenment. The meditation technique engenders clarity because in recognizing, acknowledging, and releasing thoughts, we realize that the mind's movement isn't me. We don't have to cling to it as if it were a life raft. We'll still be here even if we let go. Releasing the thoughts and returning to the breath gives us a sense of space and relief. In that instant, we are grounded, so to speak, because we can see ourselves as separate from our thoughts and emotions. There's distance between ourselves and our thoughts. Meditation allows us to relax our grip on me because we're able to see the thoughts not so much as our personal identity, but more as the effects of the speed of our mind. We gain perspective. We can see the thoughts come and go. We're not so limited by them. Suddenly, everything falls into place. We might have spent our entire life, and many lifetimes over, according to the Buddhist teachings, identifying with the movement of our mind. Now mindfulness and awareness present us with the revolutionary opportunity to observe that movement without being swept into it. It reminds me of rock climbing. If you hold tight to the rock, your forearms lock up and you can't move. There's a paralyzed quality. But if you make some distance between yourself and the rock by relaxing and leaning back, your muscles become flexible and workable. You can make your way along the rock as well as see where you're going. In the same way, by putting distance between ourselves and our thoughts, our minds become more pliable and we have more clarity about our direction in life. Once we get the hang of acknowledging thoughts and placing our minds on the breath, we take a step toward the center of the circle. Here, we might meet the full-blown fantasy. A fantasy is a very large thought that has the power to take us far, far away from the present moment. It's like a story that we tell ourselves, a movie that we run, a soap opera that draws us in and puts us in a trance. Because it's potent and absorbing, we'd sometimes rather believe a fantasy than reality. Under its spell, we don't even remember that we're meditating. I had a student who was in a 3-year cabin retreat. At the end of 1 year, I went to his cabin to discuss his meditation. He told me about some of his experiences. Various insights and images had come up, and he had several questions for me. He went into passionate detail about some of his ideas. He seemed to want me to confirm his experience. I listened and assured him that I found his revelations interesting. Without saying that he was right or wrong, I encouraged him to keep practicing. A year later, I paid him another visit. This time he was calmer, more relaxed. About the experiences he'd shared with me before, he said matter-of-factly, "Oh, I dropped all that. I realized it was just a giant thought. It lasted about a year, and in the past few months I've just seen it for what it was and let it go. It felt like dispersing a cloud." He seemed much more at ease with himself, as if he'd made an important and courageous discovery, and he had. Thoughts can last for a long time before we recognize them, but if we keep practicing, we'll see them for what they are. If we're fantasizing about going on a long holiday canoeing on the Amazon River, we can see the foliage and taste what we're going to eat at the next meal. But it may take a very long time to notice what we're doing with our minds. When we begin to meditate, we can consider ourselves well-trained if we're just able to see that we're fantasizing, even if we're caught up for most of a meditation session. Sooner or later, we see how fantasy, about food, sex, revenge, who said what to whom, what we're going to do when we're finished practicing, has the power to take over our mind. We begin to see how fantasy can continually keep us from the present moment, how it steals our ability to focus, to move forward in our training. At the end of the session, we can ask ourselves, how much of the time was I actually here? How many countries and how many people did I visit? A great deal of the session will have been about dealing with those wild, very intricate thoughts. We use the technique of holding our mind to the breath to help steady us enough to deal with the wild thoughts. Learning to recognize the fantasy and release ourselves from it is how we build up some kind of strength. The instruction for working with a fantasy is just like the instruction for working with any other thought. As soon as we notice this kind of distraction taking place, we acknowledge it as thinking and kiss it goodbye. We have to say goodbye to that very potent thought that might hold all the anger we've cooked up, or all the sexual energy, or all the insecurity. Still, we acknowledge it and return to the breath if we can. Sometimes it's just asking too much of ourselves to be that precise. Holding the mind too tightly can be harmful. When our control is too tight, the mind will bolt at the earliest opportunity. Fantasy takes us so far away. Having a romantic vacation in Tahiti, fighting with our mother in another state, that we aren't even aware of our body, not to mention the breath. Suddenly dropping a very big thought for the immediacy of the breath can be too harsh. In working with large thoughts, upsizing the object of our meditation offers a more gentle approach. We can change the size of the pasture for the horse. One way to work with large thoughts is simply to bring yourself back to the room you're sitting in. Try to remain present in the room and let the environment ground you until you feel yourself in your body. Then reconnect with the breathing. If there are small thoughts coming up, we might appreciate them. Before, I was thinking about being at the North Pole. Now I'm wondering what's for dinner. That's an improvement. And it is. At least we're here. If we have a couple of smaller thoughts, that's not a problem. We're at least somewhat here. Coming back in stages and gradually re-engaging the breath is one of the most effective ways to work with fantasies. Fantasies play a large supporting role in maintaining the "have a nice day" approach. They feed on hope and fear, which creates worry. We don't need to spend our meditation worrying. Worrying and anxiety lead to stress, and stress causes suffering. The suffering created by hope and fear routinely clouds our perception of what is happening in the present moment. We're busy spinning our best and worst case scenarios, rather than relaxing where we are. Our root fantasy is that I am real, and that there is a way to make me happy. The reason we meditate is to let that fantasy unravel. After a while, we notice that much of what we took to be real and permanent about ourselves isn't so solid. It's a string of thoughts we hold together with tremendous effort. We've built an identity out of a thin web of concepts. It can be as simple as thinking that we'll be happy if we just get what we want. As we venture into the next circle of shamatha, we encounter strong emotions. Even in our most tranquil, open-minded state, it is hard to work with emotions. So first we slow down, breathe, and stabilize our mind. Then we can take one of two approaches. The first one depends on our ability to stick with the technique. If we developed our practice to the point where we can just breathe and let a strong emotion go, that's what we should do. Relying on our stable mind, we can let the power of our meditation bring us back to the breath, which gives us space. Then the emotion begins to lose its grip. The other approach is to dismantle the emotion by contemplating it. Dismantling is grounded in knowing that no matter how solid that emotion feels, it's fabricated. Everything in the world is made of parts, and emotion is no different. The most painful, powerful aspect of negative emotions is that they seem complete and whole. A thought builds into a crescendo called emotion, which we then embody. The tight ball of hatred, desire, or jealousy feels so solid that we actually feel it in our body as a lump in our throat, a rising wave of heat, an aching heart. When we're caught up in negativity, it's hard to imagine penetrating it, cracking its shell. If we're caught in hatred, for example, it possesses us totally. Body, speech, and mind. Even if we don't act it out by shouting at someone or slamming a door, we let it burn like a wildfire in our mind, stoking it with thoughts of aggression, the desire to do harm. Let's say we're flying in an airplane. In one moment, the flight attendant is serving us food and drink, and in the next, the airplane makes a sudden drop. One minute we feel safe, then fear is all there is. Even though the pilot quickly regains control of the plane, it takes us a long time to regain control of our mind. Even when we're safely on the ground, the fear is so solid that we feel nervous about flying again. Especially as we develop stability and balance, we begin to see how our mind forms itself into various emotions. An emotion that feels as big as a house can be dismantled brick by brick. In dismantling, we use the emotion as the object of meditation. Emotion is a response to something or somebody. It isn't premeditated or logical in any way. The way dismantling works is that we engage the missing element, reason. We begin investigating the feeling. Why am I jealous? What has made me feel this way? For a moment, we rest our mind on these questions instead of the breath. The more reason we have, the more effective our ability to dismantle will be. In contemplating the reasons that our negative emotions have come together, and how they create pain, suffering, and anxiety, we can begin to take them apart. With reason, we see the source of the emotion, what somebody said to us, the disappointment of an expectation we were holding. Maybe the reason isn't a person, but an object. A chair or a car or a piece of clothing or food is behind our desire or hatred or jealousy. When we contemplate the emotion, we begin to see that the person or object is not the reason for what we feel. We are the reason. The emotion is a creation of our mind. We've turned a thought into a seemingly solid entity and held onto it. In every emotional situation, there's a subject, an object, and an action. For example, riding in a car in India is a frustrating experience. The roads are barely wide enough for one car, and they're very bumpy. When you're stuck behind a slow truck that's spewing diesel smoke, as it seems they all do, There's every reason to want to pass, but it's rarely possible. You become obsessed with the road, the truck, and your desire. And after a while, all you can think about is how angry you are. When you finally pass, you see that the truck driver is just a poor man trying to eke out a living. Your anger lightens immediately. In this situation, the subject is me, the object is the truck, and the action is being stuck behind it. The pain of the situation is also the object. You're angry at the truck for being where it is, and at yourself for being where you are. You're also angry at being stuck in traffic, and you're angry at being angry. These are the components of this emotion. As we think about these components, the anger falls apart. The thought draws us closer to the anger, which is important. Keeping our distance from emotion has a solidifying effect. By contemplating it, we begin to weaken its power to hold us captive, which creates space. The coolness of reason, looking at the emotion, questioning where it came from, seeking the source, investigating the object, dissipates the heat of the emotion. We begin to wonder why we invest so much energy in this feeling that we've created with our own mind. The bottom line is that everything comes together and everything falls apart. Slowly we regain perspective, calm, composure, and dignity. We see that there is no anger, no desire, no attachment. Our mind feels lighter, and we can once again place it on the breath. Sometimes neither letting go nor dismantling works. We're too traumatized to use intelligence or logic, or to recognize and release. We're totally possessed, and contemplating the emotion only inflames it further. We're too close to the action. It's too soon to investigate the scene of the accident. In this case, we need to calm down and relax. The best thing might be to get involved in a soothing activity. Go for a walk, take a shower, read a book, talk to a friend, watch a movie. When we're calmer, we can come back to the cushion. Knowing when we can meditate is honest meditation. In the next circle of shamatha, we meet discursive thoughts or wildness. These thoughts are distracting, but not nearly as powerful or disruptive as fantasies or strong emotions. Discursiveness is the chatter that constantly clutters our mind, the routine mental buzz. It's made of random, non-associated thoughts as opposed to fully drawn-out storylines. Even though it's more permeable than fantasy or strong emotion, this ordinary discursiveness is adept at keeping us trapped in me. It's like a low-level hum that obscures our natural clarity. As we meditate, we can bounce back and forth in our mind about what's going on at school or work, conversations we had or would like to have, plans for the rest of the day, and basically still be aware that we're meditating. Occasionally, we surface from these excursions into the past and future by returning to the breath, but then the movement of our mind invites us to wander off again. Discursiveness feels like flipping through television channels. An old movie here, sports there, soap opera over there, and now the news. We might experience it as the nagging desire to scratch our nose, or as wondering how many minutes before our session's over. Discursiveness has the quality of high vibration, which has a peculiarly deadening effect. At the end of 20 minutes of meditation, it can leave you thinking, "What was that?" In working with discursiveness, we might be tempted to be loose in our control. However, it's essential to repeatedly place our mind on the breath. Recognize the thought, acknowledge it, let it dissolve, and return to the breath. This breaks up the river of discursiveness. Don't think about what kind of thought you're having. Just see it for what it is, and place your mind elsewhere. Experiencing the mind's movement at this level is much of our training in shamatha. Working steadily with wild chatter and meditation makes maintaining mindfulness much easier to do during daily life. In working with discursiveness, our practice becomes very precise. This precision takes us to the innermost circle of peaceful abiding, where we become aware of very subtle thoughts arising in our stillness. It's like standing next to an iced-over mountain stream. We hear water popping up in tiny bubbles. The thoughts come through like whispers. In our steady mindfulness of the breath, a little voice breaks through.